And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let me first introduce two guests for you. The first, of course, has been on the program several years ago, David Talbot. He's a comparative mythologist. He has devoted years to examining the origins of ancient beliefs, symbolic traditions, author of a number of books, The Electric Universe, Thunderbolts of the Gods, The Saturn Myth. He's written many of them with Wallace Thornhill. His reconstruction of the ancient sky was the subject of the feature documentary, Remembering the End of the World, back on Coast to Coast, David Talbot. David, how are you?
Well, hi, George. I'm doing well. I'm
looking forward to
this.
Thank
you very much for the invitation.
Great work. Wallace Thornhill, of course, Australian physicist, lifelong investigation of the electric universe, offers a revolutionary view of the solar system, nature of the sun, the behavior of comets, and stellar and galactic evolution. He has written a number of books with David Talbot, of course, Thunderbolts of the Gods, and that will be coming out in the Electric Universe, available on June 1st. So I'm looking forward to all of this. Wallace, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, George, and once again, thanks for the invitation.
My pleasure. For both of you, big story today coming out is Japanese astronomers are finding free-floating planets that don't seem to orbit a star. Have you seen this story yet, Wallace?
No, I haven't. I've been very busy writing a paper for a natural philosophy meeting in Washington in July.
Okay, it's a great story. David, how about you? You want to talk
about
it?
Well, I've seen the story, but I'll tell you what. Wall would be the one to answer the question as to what does it mean that planets divorced from parent bodies, stars and so on, might be floating around in the space between stars in greater numbers than the stars themselves. I mean, that's how I understood the story. I don't have any insight, actually, that I could offer as to the mystery there. It wasn't expected. I think maybe Wall does have some thought about that.
It's a strange story, Wallace, in that, you know, they're saying that they found 10 planets the size of Jupiter that don't seem to be connected to any solar system.
Right. Well, that's the kind of thing I would expect. There was another report just last month where the Herschel Space Telescope has been peering into the dusty clouds where stars are formed. And they were surprised to find that the stars are formed simultaneously in strings, like beads on a necklace. And this, of course, was expected by Hans Alfvén and plasma physicists for decades. But astronomers are surprised by it because, unfortunately, they don't attend plasma meetings. The point is that the same mechanism that forms stars in something like a lightning bolt, if you like, in a cloud. So it's like cloud-to-cloud lightning in space. And just as a lightning bolt compresses the material around it and then creates that incredible bang, the same thing happens in deep space, only the result there is that you get a whole lot of beads, which are stars or planet-sized objects like Jupiter's. And, of course, after the event, they scatter. So I would expect to find Jupiter-sized objects floating in space. This, of course, is quite different to the standard view where you make planets by the leftovers from the gradual contraction of material to form a star under the force of gravity. This has never been shown to work, but it's clung to because it's the only idea that's been popular for centuries probably now.
Well, what's so exciting, Wallace and David, is we just don't know what's out there. We're still finding new information, new things, new discoveries all the time, aren't we?
That's right. And I think the important point is that it's the conventional picture of astronomy and what's going on out there that gets a surprise every time. And it's those who follow the new plasma cosmology and the electric universe who are not surprised because we've been able to show how all of these things fit without trying to invent new theories or forces or invisible matter and all the other kinds of things that you see in the popular news.
David, years ago, a fellow by the name of Emmanuel Velikovsky wrote a book called Worlds and Collisions, and you got involved somehow. Tell me.
Boy, I sure did, George. I was something of a youngster back then. It was a life-changing experience for me to discover Velikovsky's work and then to actually begin following up. First with Velikovsky himself. I was the founder and publisher of a 10-issue magazine formatted series on Velikovsky that gained a great deal of attention globally. And but more than that, I found myself drawn into following pointers that had been provided by Velikovsky as to what really happened in ancient times. And the more I dug into that, the more convinced I became that Velikovsky had actually diagnosed something very fundamental. No matter that he was wrong on so many particulars, and I think all of us who've really spent decades investigating Velikovsky would be the best critics of this pioneering theorist, because we could see that there were ways in which he was using evidence that won't stand up. But what Velikovsky showed through systematic analysis is that all of the evidence from the ancient cultures speaks for catastrophe in ancient times. It was catastrophe remembered by the early cultures that completely dominated human imagination when the first civilizations arose. And these memories persisted for thousands of years. So what does that mean? Well, it means, for one thing, that there's a story to reconstruct. So the way you use the evidence is very important. I just found that the points of agreement between the different cultures on specific details, those constituted the bedrock of a reconstruction. It didn't look entirely like Velikovsky's scenario, but it became very coherent. Now, the centerpiece of Velikovsky's scenario was the idea that the planet Venus was this spectacular comet roaming the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Captured, so, right?
Yeah, it captured in some sense. I don't think Velikovsky had a clear idea as to how that happened. I mean, he was proposing that it was actually expelled by Jupiter. Now, I don't think anybody can totally exclude that, but from the vantage point on the evidence that I was accumulating, that was not a centerpiece. The comet Venus terrifying the ancient world was a centerpiece, and the reason for that is that every ancient symbol and word for a comet was attached to Venus. There is a story of a great comet that Velikovsky began to unravel, and I just picked up on that along with his pointers back to the planet Saturn, and that gradually enabled me to reconstruct a coherent and highly unified picture of an ancient story of catastrophe. It became for me very testable, George. Once it was clarified, its implications became crystal clear, and it became increasingly easy to determine if cultures around the world would indeed support this particular implication. And eventually that can be taken out to the planetary surfaces, and you can see that the things that are required from this reconstruction, they are found on the planetary surfaces. And what is just shouting to us is that these surfaces were carved from pole to pole by electricity.
And let me ask you, Velikovsky was scorned, though, for his theories at the time, wasn't he, David?
Oh, he was completely dismissed. And that was part of the reason for my interest in Velikovsky, because the one thing that I'd always been interested in before I had any interest in school, even, I mean, in the seventh grade, eighth grade, up into high school, I really had no interest in school, but I was very interested in odd things, the paranormal, the unusual, the idea that people hadn't yet accepted but had promised. There was just something that intuitively intrigued me about that. And the Velikovsky question, because I had read Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision 2 or 3, 4 years before we began publishing that series on Velikovsky, I just found it extremely interesting that a person of his caliber who could gather that level of evidence. I mean, he was a colleague of Albert Einstein's. He was a respected psychoanalyst. He moved in very scholarly circles, but when he published that book, he was finished in terms of his academic and scholarly reputation. The point here is actually the story isn't over yet, George. I mean, if Venus was a comet, the picture of solar system history has changed completely.
Sure.
And I can tell you that every person in our circle, I mean, we have dozens of people who have gotten really involved seriously in this kind of question. There isn't one of them who has stood up and said, well, I don't really think that Venus was a comet. The evidence is just overwhelming. So it seems clear to me that there's going to be no escaping a reckoning within the theoretical sciences. And in the end, it's going to be, yes, Venus was a comet. We have to get used to that because its implications are very sweeping.
We'll talk more about that. Now, Wallace Velikovsky dies in November of 1979, but you visited him, I think, before that all happened, didn't you?
That's right. Just 6 months before, in May, I took the family up from Washington, D.C. to his home in New Jersey, and he and his wife very graciously entertained our family. I went specifically to ask him about the biggest challenge that the astronomers had thrown down, and that was that his work defied the laws of Newton, you know, the gravitational laws, the motion laws, and so on. And it seemed to me that this was the crux of the matter, and I wanted to understand how it could be that Venus was a comet in the past, and yet today it has an almost perfectly circular orbit. And also this would have had to have happened quickly. I think the point is that Velikovsky actually threw down a gauntlet, so to speak, to the astronomers and said that if Newton was sacrosanct, then his work was a heresy. So they just chose the option that his was a heresy because that was easier and they didn't have to rewrite any of their work. Whereas I was interested in the amount of evidence that Velikovsky had put forward that Venus had been a comet, and therefore it was a question that had to be answered, and his gauntlet had to be picked up. We spoke about the possible electrical nature of gravity, and I know that Velikovsky had been corresponding and meeting with Einstein before Einstein died, and I believe that Einstein had become sufficiently interested that he was on the point of asking for certain experiments to be done or tests to be made. But unfortunately, he died before any of that could be carried out.
Well, it was an incredible theory,
yes,
I've got the book.
I think that he was more open-minded than the people who followed him, and this is a trap that scientists and everyone falls into. It becomes a fashion, and anyone who breaks away from the fashion tends to be ostracized. And that's what happened to Velikovsky.
David, I want to get into some of the catastrophes of the comet in a moment, but Wallace, if you can, tell me, how could a comet get captured and then turn into an orbit that Venus now has, where so many people think it's just part of the solar system, always was? How do you think that could have occurred?
Well, I've actually published on my website my view of how that happened. And I came to the conclusion shortly after meeting Velikovsky that he was on the right track, although it required a bit more work, and that gravity is actually an electric force between neutral atoms, neutral matter. It's the same kind of thing that allows us to exist on this Earth. All solids and liquids, for instance, are held together by electrical forces between otherwise neutral atoms. But gravity is very interesting because it has certain features which just don't match with our understanding of the electric force. But the upshot of it was that I found that the exchange of electrical charge between celestial bodies, and a comet is exchanging charge in its brilliant display, that exchange of charge actually modifies the gravitational force between that body and all other bodies in the solar system. And I have found that, I've proposed anyway, that it works in such a way as to cause a comet like Venus to achieve a stable orbit fairly quickly. And this is something that can't happen with the gravitational theory as
right.
It stands now. And we just have to get used to the idea that our present understanding of gravity is actually zero. We have mathematical equations which describe what happens, and which describe orbits and so on, but there is no understanding of the force of gravity.
Now, the comet, Venus, is zooming into our solar system at a pretty astounding rate. At what point, Wallace, does it start to slow down? Because it's got to slow down.
It starts to slow down when it begins to hurl thunderbolts the thunderbolts of the gods between other bodies like Mars and the Earth and so on. And these thunderbolts were witnessed by the ancients, and that was a clue as to the nature of gravity, that it had to have some connection with electricity, just as Velikovsky had proposed. So there was plenty of evidence that that was the direction to go in. So it's this thunderbolts of the gods which is crucial.
David, explain the thunderbolts.
Well, it's interesting. Thunderbolts of the gods were actually, they actually gave Wall Thornhill and me a bridge. The thunderbolts of the gods become the bridge between a reconstruction of ancient events and plasma science and the electric universe. So that was what we titled our first book, because we could see that it is possible to approach questions of this sort from both a scientific vantage point and a historical reconstruction. The cosmic thunderbolt in the ancient world is an incredibly mysterious phenomenon. I mean, the thunderbolt of the gods was the prototype for every warrior hero's weapon. I mean, when you see the arrows of Apollo,
yes, you're right,
or the spears of warrior gods, you think that these were just based on human extrapolations from warrior figures and so on known to various tribal cultures. But that isn't the story at all. These weapons originally meant the thunderbolt. These were the weapons of the gods. The archetypal, the original form, looked nothing like lightning, but it was called the thunderbolt. And this form is now explained down to many finite details by high-energy experiments in plasma laboratories. This was one of the bridges that brought me into direct communication with Anthony Perrat. Now, this was going back like 11 years almost, but he was the leading authority on the highest energy plasma instabilities in the laboratory, and his colleagues named these instabilities after him. The similarity between those formations in the laboratory, it's a very exotic form, you just would have to see it. But the similarity between those forms and the forms of the cosmic thunderbolt and other mythical forms that I had reconstructed just based on the accord between different cultures is just quite astounding. And that was what redirected Anthony Perrat's life's work, going back 11 years now. I mean, this is a story unto itself, and I presume we'll have lots of time to talk about it.
Well, yeah. And the thunderbolts, David, must have been millions and millions of years of miles long.
Well, I can't tell you a whole lot about how big they were, other than that it was cosmic. In other words, there were planetary forms extremely close to the Earth. This earlier phase of solar system history, it has nothing in common with the way the planets look today. You have to imagine these bodies in a very close congregation presenting this spectacular evolving configuration above us. It's an electrified configuration, and the plasma discharge formations, the electric arcs in the plasma environment between these planets, gave the form to the cosmic thunderbolt. And there were certain implications that came out of this reconstruction. I mean, it became obvious that due to the strategic location of Mars along these axes of discharge, that that body would have to have a huge hemispheric discontinuity. You know, the northern hemisphere just must be totally different from the south, because...
David, hold on for a second. And welcome back to Coast with Dave Talbot, Wallace Thornhill. Let's get back to you, Dave, if we can. Some of these catastrophes that may have occurred because of Venus, are we talking about the flood of Noah's era, things like that?
Well, now, George, okay, that's the toughest kind of question, because our memories collectively, our cultural memories, are cluttered with all kinds of themes that are not integrated in any way. It all just seems incredibly chaotic. I mean, it's well acknowledged that virtually every ancient culture had a tradition of a great catastrophe. This would be a world-ending catastrophe. And many cultures had memories of a disastrous flood. Now, the flood figures very prominently in this reconstruction. It's very hard to establish the context for this without other things becoming clear first. Everything comes down to there was a land of the gods. It was not Earth. There was a land of the gods. It was a formation in the sky dominated by planetary forms that were called gods. But in the course of storytelling, over the centuries, the stories of these gods were translated into legendary ancestors, into great men, into ruling kings, into princesses and fairy figures, and so on. So how do we approach this issue of clarifying the story? The nature of this formation in the sky, the dwelling of the gods, which was in fact the subject of the primitive creation, the archaic creation legend. All of the creation legends describe the bringing forth of the dwelling of the gods. Now, the doomsday catastrophe must have had a horrific consequence for the earth. But in the first stories, in the earliest records of that doomsday event, the victims are the gods themselves. The world that is overwhelmed is that spectacular dwelling of the gods in the sky. And you can prove this beyond any reasonable doubt by taking the components of that story, like there is this world mountain, there is this cosmic mountain. Where does the dwelling of the gods lie? It lies on the summit of this mountain, remembered as the world's highest mountain. So this isn't our world at all. Our world was never a subject of the archaic myths. That's the hard thing to register. You have to be able to show this to people in terms of the symbols and the design elements and the practices and the monumental memory, the cultural monument building that was always pointing back to this archaic memory of the land of the gods. The deluge was the devastation and the end of that configuration in the sky.
Why,
not the familiar story.
Why are people so fearful of comets, much more than just about any other kind of heavenly object?
It's because there was a doomsday comet. And everything we ever thought about comets, every symbol, every hieroglyph for comets, anywhere in the world, was given by the symbolism or the story of the great comet. And that figure was Venus. So there's a character of the planet Venus that stands out amongst the early cultures. And it will always culminate in the story of the terrible comet Venus, this frightful form in the sky. And that form, incidentally, is nothing else than the terrible aspect of the mother goddess.
It must have looked huge, David, as it was approaching. Huge.
Oh, well, it wasn't just huge. It was earth-threatening in every sense of the phrase. And it was discharging to a spectacular level. Now, where did this story of the mother goddess, the form in the sky that personified light and radiance and glory and love, and life, how did it happen that that story around the world culminates in this goddess growing angry, the terrible goddess, the angry goddess, the witch, the hag, and so on, threatening to destroy the world, raging across the sky with this wildly disheveled, fiery, smoky hair? That's the story of the great comet. Now ask yourself this. How many cultures in the world did not remember Venus as the mother goddess? There's only one planet that any culture called the mother goddess. Now, that is telling you, don't believe in accidents. That couldn't be just a coincidence. It's the coherent memory speaking in the early astronomies. The mother goddess is this planet, Venus. Now, that's worldwide. That's oceanic. That's the Americas. That's throughout the Near East, China, ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia. Always, Mother Goddess is the planet Venus.
And that's the best way they could describe it at the time, isn't it?
That is it exactly, George. See, they had no other language.
Wallace, when, if Velikovsky is correct, when was this comet captured?
This is a question that we can't really answer definitively, because all the usual methods of dating have to be looked at again if this sort of interference occurred on a planetary scale. I think there's sort of round figures at the end of the last ice age, you know, something like 10, 12 or so thousand years ago.
So not a long time in terms of space time.
Certainly not, and certainly not in terms of geological time either. It means that, some of the things that we see on the Earth's surface and on other planetary surfaces are very young indeed. But as I said, the normal geological method of dating has to be looked at again in the aftermath of these very intense electrical discharges, which can cause nuclear reactions to occur.
What would cause Velikovsky to even think that Venus was a captured comet? What were the signs that he saw?
I think from his book, Worlds in Collision, that he was using that forensic technique that both Dave and I have followed, and that is you look at a whole lot of unreliable witnesses and their statements, and you pick out the odd things which they all seem to remember, even though they may describe it differently. And I think that was the trigger for me. It made me feel that Velikovsky had made a very strong case, and that it couldn't be just dismissed on the grounds that somebody didn't believe it conformed to their law.
Well, that's a good point.
Yes.
And David, why does it seem that modern science is afraid to admit the possibility, then, that Venus might have been a comet?
There you are dealing with all of the forces of momentum, the momentum of prior belief. And one of the things I've become increasingly conscious of is that this affects science at every conceivable level. The momentum of belief is acting through funding processes. There's something that we call science by news release. As scientific institutions are continually having to justify their funding, there are relationships to the news media, there are relationships to television programmers and so on. Now, if you look at the way all of this works, there's a huge amount of momentum. There is the authoring of textbooks, there are academic positions, there are scientific organizations. Now, there is peer-reviewed research. Now, all of these things are part of the momentum or the perpetuation of an idea, whether it is right or wrong. So people have today a great deal to lose if they have been fundamentally wrong. Now, how wrong might science be if it allows Venus to have been a comet in ancient times? Number one, the Velikovsky affair immediately leaps out at us. You mean science was wrong in its dismissal of Velikovsky? But we all knew Velikovsky was wrong. Now, so that's part of the issue, but it's just a small part. It was said that the planet Venus cannot have been a comet because it's as big as the Earth. The escape velocity of gases would be like 25,000 miles per hour.
Right.
I was going to say,
in terms of size, it's a pretty big comet, isn't it?
Well, the size, as Wall would be the first to emphasize, if it's moving through the electric field of the sun, it is going to produce an incredible display. But what electric field of the sun? You can't have a comet Venus unless you grant an electric field of the sun. Well, what textbook has ever talked about an electric field of the sun?
Yeah.
Well, there's such momentum behind that you will see a complete rewriting of solar system history and solar physics, which couldn't stop at the boundary of the sun's domain. It would affect everything we see out in space going on within the Milky Way. But that has to have its explanation and things going on beyond the Milky Way. So There's nothing left of the standard ideology if Venus was a comet. It really is that sweeping. It's like the dominoes just fall, and it's an irreversible effect.
Might it have been even bigger than it is now?
Well, as a form in the sky, it definitely was bigger because it had this spectacular coma, and it was shooting out these jets of material and discharging in all these different directions. It was just an unbelievable form in the sky, and so you wouldn't get anything like that with a little mile wide or 2 mile wide comet coming into the solar system. But this was completely dominating the fears of humanity around the world.
Any idea where it might have come from?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. within the context of the reconstruction, now this is where you have to have pictures, and I hope it's okay for me to mention a website.
Oh, absolutely.
Anybody that
absolutely
wants to come to thunderbolts.info, that's thunderbolts.info, we'll find pointers in all kinds of directions to see the kind of thing that we're talking about. And you'll see images, the image from the DVD, Symbols of an Alien Sky, there's Venus just blazing away right in the center of another larger planet. And you can see there's a strategic relationship there then between that blazing radial discharge form of Venus and the larger planet behind it and the smaller planet in front of it, which is Mars. This is a very concrete and it is a very specific reconstruction. The implications of this reconstruction follow from the points of agreement between all of the ancient cultures. And that was all I worked with. If it wasn't a point of accord between the different cultures, I didn't worry about it. And the surprise was that all of these different cultural themes, the mythic archetypes, they are all clarifying each other. They're all speaking to each other. That was the basis of confidence that led me to then look out at the planet Mars to see if what would be required in that role of Mars, if it's actually present. Is it possible that Mars was carved miles deep by electricity? Well, I spent several months, actually just a year ago, several months producing a complete survey of the defining features of Mars. And the only force that can explain these features, and I really mean the only force, is electric discharge. And that DVD is out now. It's the lightning-scarred planet Mars. It's having an extremely positive effect right now with people who are looking at it.
Well, that's pretty dramatic. And next hour, we'll talk, of course, about Mars and Saturn and some other things going on in space. Wallace, what would Albert Einstein say about all of this tonight?
I think he'd be delighted, actually. He was, as I said, I think he was open-minded enough to want to know the truth. And so that he was ready to dismiss his own work. He was, in fact, felt that it would all be dismissed sometime in the future. But as David was talking about, this juggernaut of science is very difficult to turn it around. So I respect Einstein for his integrity, but I think the people who have followed him have just gone off playing mathematical games, which have no relevance to our situation in the universe.
What do we know about the asteroid belt? What do you think might have been there? I've never ever subscribe to the theory that it's a planet that just didn't form?
No. When you look at material from meteorites and asteroids and so on, there is the signature of an cosmic discharge. It's shown in meteorites in tiny little inclusions and little spheres inside, melted spheres inside the meteorites. It's shown in the spectra from asteroids, and when comet tails were sampled with the Stardust mission, it was a surprise to astronomers that they found the minerals that you would expect from a differentiated planet. The simple answer is that the asteroid belt is one of those regions in the solar system where very powerful sculpting of one of the planets, or maybe several planets, occurred. And I would suggest that Mars and a lot of the material that's missing from Mars is there in the form of the asteroid belt.
Would you agree with that, David?
I agree with that 100%, and it's a perfect example how at this level of such detail, such specificity, a reconstruction based on things remembered around the world meets up perfectly with the physics of the electric universe.
Well, it's all pretty dramatic. And tell me about the Electric Universe, Thunderbolts of the Gods. Where can people get these publications?
Oh, well, I just gave this website address, thunderbolts.info, and whereas we don't sell anything, it's very easy to follow the links from the homepage to various resources that are offered by Michamar Publishing. And we have a DVD called Symbols of an Alien Sky. It's actually the first in a series, and it is a visual reconstruction of a towering planetary formation described around the world. And that formation is very specific and leads to acid tests. In other words, if the events described at this level of specificity actually occurred, it should be remarkably easy to either disprove the theory or to confirm its explicit, its inescapable implications. Now, one of the implications is the scarring of Mars. You just would have to see the way Mars appears in these configurations. I mean, like the great warrior of antiquity, always identified as Mars. He wears this conical crown. But why is this conical crown the Mother Goddess herself? I mean, this is very explicit. And that's the discharge occurring between Mars and Venus. Now, this means that its hemisphere was eaten away miles deep. Well, I had to examine this at a level of detail that actually caused me to delay the second episode of Symbols of an Alien Sky that I had originally visualized. I had to determine if it really is true that hemispheric discharging of Mars could have occurred that profoundly. And here's an amazing fact. Mars not only exhibits this hemispheric difference, the southern hemisphere is just blasted with craters. The northern hemisphere has virtually none.
None, yeah.
And the amazing thing is its crust has been eaten away up to 6 miles deep, eaten away, excavated. It's not that the sphere is just distorted. The crust has disappeared.
Where'd it go?
Yeah, it's falling on Earth even today. It's the meteorites from Mars. It's the red dust from Mars.
Are we the Martians?
No.
You don't think?
Well, I mean, maybe, you know, who knows?
You know?
I mean, maybe. I don't know if we can actually answer some of these things. I know that there is a lot of fascination with the possibility that, well, we came from Mars. It just got too disastrous. I tend to doubt that, but it's not within the domain of my research at all, actually.
All right. Well, stay with us, both of you. We're going to come back a couple more hours to go. We're going to talk about multiverses, Mars, Saturn, and what you think about the shuttle and the fact that we might not be going up with a shuttle after one more launch. I'm pretty sure of that.